Support comes from Cap UCLA, presenting Tiago Rodriguez by heart on Friday, October 24th and Saturday, October 25th at the Nimoy. Rodriguez, a Portuguese playwright and actor, invites 10 audience members onto the stage and teaches them a poem, an act inspired by his grandmother's journey to blindness. More info and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Hello, this is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we're going to look at how workers are fighting for dignity and better working conditions in so-called right-to-work states, places where the anti-union climate, legal roadblocks, and intimidation make winning union recognition seem nearly impossible. Across the country, there are some 38,000 dollar store workers at Dollar General, Family Dollar, and Dollar Tree, where short staffing, poverty wages, and dangerous conditions are the norm. Today, we're going to highlight a successful campaign in Louisiana where workers stood up for safer workplaces and better pay. And instead of waiting for legal recognition, these workers are organizing and acting like a union without one. It's an approach known as pre-majority unionism, and it can deliver real gains. My guests are Jesse Baum, reporter for Capital in Maine, and David Williams, a Dollar General worker and organizer with Step Up Louisiana. We're going to talk about how these campaigns are winning raises and safety audits through direct action and solidarity outside the formal protections of the NLRB, which is now hobbled under Trump's second administration. When the law fails to protect workers, they're proving that collective action still works and may well be showing us the future of the labor movement itself. All this when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Capital in Maine reporter Jesse Baum and David Williams, a Dollar General stalker in New Orleans, are organizing with Step Up Louisiana. And they're with us to discuss organizing when formal unionization is blocked by law and intimidation. What does it mean to rebuild workers' power when the system is rigged against you? Baum and Williams explore the rise of pre-majority unionism, a strategy where workers organize and win improvements without formal recognition from the National Labor Relations Board. Groups like Step Up Louisiana show how pre-majority unionism can win tangible gains, especially in the anti-union South amid Trump's assault on labor law. These minority unions act like unions anyway, walking out, marching on shareholders, forcing companies to raise wages and improve safety, and gain respect on the job. So we're going to ask if this kind of organizing can chart a path forward for labor in America, especially in low-wage sectors where the legal framework for unions is crumbling. We're going to explore these questions with our guests, Jesse Baum and David Williams. So let me properly introduce you and welcome to the show. Jesse Baum is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in Anti-Gravity magazine, Capital in Maine, The American Prospect, and the Louisiana Illuminator. She's been contributing to Capital Maine and Maine's labor series called Striking Back since 2023. And her latest article in this series is up on the Capital in Maine website, and it's titled Dollar Store Workers Fight to Improve Jobs Even Without a Union. And David Williams is with us. He works at Dollar General, and he's an integral member of Step Up Louisiana in New Orleans. He's been described as a fearless voice championing the rights of workers everywhere, and he's won the National Kosh Health and Safety Activist Award for his commitment to raising public awareness and improving safety on the job. I want to welcome both of you to the show. So happy to see you here.
Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. So I guess let's just get started. So the first question, or looking at it, is this really an inside look at the retail sector, which is kind of the epicenter of America's low-wage economy. You used to call it the service sector, but it's only a small part of it. But in this article, we learn that there's 38,000 dollar stores, and most of them pay near minimum wage and have minimal safety protections. They've been in the news in the past for violence as well occurring on the work site. And yet, we're seeing from New Orleans to Tennessee and even in North Carolina, workers are learning to act like a union even when they can't formally get one. So I want to just ask you, Jesse, to begin by talking about what drew you to this story.
Sure. Thank you for that introduction. So I've been writing for this series since 2023. And as I'm sure your listeners are aware, since 2023, things have changed quite a lot politically in our country, and especially when it comes to what the executive branch, which controls the NLRB to some extent, they appoint new members every 2 years, or they're a 6-year term. So they're staggered throughout presidential administrations. So some of it has been covering unionism as we kind of are used to thinking about it, where workers get together and they file for a election with the NLRB. And then, you know, if they win this election, then they start the process of negotiating a collective bargaining agreement, their first contract. But things were never easy. That was never an easy fight under Trump, and with Trump firing the general counsel for the NLRB. And currently the 5-member national board has 1 member on it. The federal government is shut down. Things are even harder. So it was kind of like, okay, well, what can we report about that's like looking outside of this traditional unionism when it seems like things are going to have to change? And I had been hearing about the rallies that workers had organized in New Orleans, and Williams can definitely talk more about that. But I thought that that was a really interesting campaign. And it's also different because instead of organizing at one work site, these workers are organizing across work sites and across different companies. So when you're organizing for a union under the NLRB, you can only organize within your company through your employer, whereas this campaign is taking place across different companies and different work sites. So I thought that was really cool. And I wanted to learn more.
I'm really glad you brought all of those things up, because maybe for listeners who don't pay a great deal of attention to labor, they should probably know that, you know, winning the National Relations Labor Act, the Wagner Act in the 30s, was a huge gain. It allowed workers the right to unionize and then union protection and all sorts of other things. But there's been a fight back ever since. And now I often talk to people who live, say, in Britain and otherwise, and they can't understand what the difficulty is in American organizing. And the difficulty is that when workers want to organize, they have to do so with their hands handcuffed behind their back, literally. So labor law makes it even more difficult. And some people have said in the past that, you know, it's maybe the old form of wildcat strikes. It might get you further. But that's a different question. I'm really glad you at least raised that and showed also how difficult it is in the present phase. David, I wanted to ask you, first, just welcome to the show and congratulations on all your organizing efforts. But maybe you could describe for our listeners what the conditions were at Dollar General, where you work, that pushed you to start organizing.
Well, before I even knew what this was or what I joined up on, I was an actual customer, and I was previously working at a previous job before I became a dollar store worker or even working at Dollar General. So by me just being a customer, I started to recognize like customers being agitated, disrespected, and then employees were like the same thing. You know, some had like personal issues, some had like personal problems, and it's like nobody felt safe in that store. And I didn't even know how bad the pay was before I even joined. So even by being a dollar store worker now, and of course, I'm close to where I work at now, you know, so it's like walking distance for me. So when I did become a dollar store worker, that's when I realized like why customers are so agitated and why employees are so distraught, because there is no safety inside that store. it's always something going on. And it's like even with managers who don't show up the proper respect in terms of, you know, respecting our personal life when we have a life. And it's like when you constantly messing up people's schedules, you know, there is no end side of it. So to me, looking at that structure in and outside that store with no protection and low pay, it has to come to an end at some point. So that's when I got in touch with one of these workers who work at Step Up. It was kind of back and forward, you know, inconsistencies and things like that. So I didn't even know the whole skinny on it, but I did get in contact with her at that time. So I lost contact with her for some apparent reason. Then I say about 2 weeks in, that's when I got this call from this head organizer named Greg Wilson. And he was the one that gave me a little more about what's going on inside these stores. So we met up at the park. Nothing wasn't really forced on me. It was just mostly just like genuine conversations. And then as we just started talking about everything, that's when it led to him giving me more information about what goes on inside these stores. And then the more he told me, the more I said, like, yeah, this is something I could really see myself doing. Like, I really want to help in any way that I can. I don't know what I can do, but whatever role you give me, I'm going to do it to the best of my ability.
Can I ask you to go back when you said that, you know, as a customer, you could sense the agitation and frustration that, you know, existed in the store and that things were unsafe. And then you said you found it again as a worker. Can you describe what is unsafe about it? Were there fights? Was there normally when I hear about unsafe working conditions, I think about machinery that is, you know, unsafe and not looked after and things like that. But I think you're describing something else.
Okay. So let's say, like, for instance, like you're either a worker or you're a customer. And every time you like go in the back part of the store, there's always fire exit that's blocked. And that's an automatic hazard. And everybody know you never block a fire exit because you don't know what's going to happen.
And I don't mean to interrupt, but like your store did burn down at one point. And this is something that Dollar General and I believe Dollar Tree have both been fined millions by OSHA for these types of infractions that can have extremely serious consequences. I just wanted to jump in with the literal fire.
It's so literally after the store burned down, was rebuilt, they were still blocking the fire exit?
Yes. Yes. And to be honest with you on that story, like I didn't even know that occurred because I was actually off that day. I wound up getting a call from my landlord. I wound up getting a call from my cousin because they was in that area at that exact time. And they both told me, hey, I don't know if you know, but your store is literally on fire right now. So I had to rush outside to go see what was going on. Before I can even get close, I see nothing but smoke in the air. And looking right across the street from that store, I just seen like flames just coming in and out that store.
There's stories of, you know, employers blocking fire exits because they don't want workers to leave without any, you know, permission, I guess. Or maybe they just stocked up stuff and stacked it against the doors. What was the case in your store?
There's a lot of theft that goes on inside dollar stores. And majority of the time, that's the most reason why they block fire exits. And depending on what they mostly block it with, that's the majority of the time where they're trying to make sure that anybody that does steal, they don't have a easy way out. Like if you know you're going to steal, like the same way you came in, the same way you're going to have to get out. So they basically block the exits to make sure thieves don't get an easy way out.
Wow.
But that doesn't keep us safe.
Right.
That puts us in more danger.
Well, both of you started to talk a little bit about the organizing outside of the framework of the unions. Jesse, maybe you could just describe what it's like in a right to work state to try to organize a union and what the, you know, how high the bar is, or let's say the improbability of winning one. But in your article, you talk about this pre-majority unionism and why it matters now. Maybe you could just describe a little bit about, you know, what it means and how the strategy evolved and what it means right now, especially under Trump's anti-labor, you know, regime, let's call it.
Sure. Like you touched on earlier, there are millions of retail workers in this country, And when the NLRA was passed, and as you touched upon, this is a deeply flawed law, but certain rights were won for workers. A lot of it was about being able to sue employers that were union busting and get, like, well, not sue for damages, but sue the employer to stop union busting, basically, because the NLRA doesn't issue fines. That's not part of it, the board's power. So retail workers are unionized at a really, really, really low rate. The national average for private sector unionization is about 6%, but for retail workers, it's about 4%. And Louisiana has also an extremely low, we are lower than the national average when it comes for unionization, and we're a right to work state, meaning that people are basically don't have to pay union dues, even if they are represented by a union. But beyond that, there has been so much at the political and I would say propaganda level to turn workers against unionization. So when union rates have gone down, and they've basically gone down since the mid-century, the mid-20th century, we also see this hostility to unions where politicians and, as I said, basically mass media have done like this really good job of convincing people that unions are not in their best interest. So when I was talking to Mackenzie Majette, who is a organizing lead for this campaign in Tennessee, which is where the Dollar General corporate headquarters are, she talks about it's actually beneficial that when people say, so is this a union? She says, well, not exactly, because people are actually quite, depending on the age group, younger people are much more pro-union, but a lot of people are very suspicious of unions. And a lot of times what I've heard when talking to various union organizers in the South is people will say, well, when you join a union, union dues are going to take all of your salary, because that's what they've been told by managers, and that's what they've been hearing from politicians. And what a lot of union organizers will say, and this, of course, immediately makes sense, is like, well, you, the workers, are going to vote on a contract, and you would never agree to a contract that ultimately lowered your pay. And we do know that belonging in a union and having a union contract does result in higher wages for workers. But pre-majority unionism is basically saying, like, There are so many tools in the anti-union playbook. Employers basically, under Biden's and Biden's NLRB, certain tactics were basically like approved in the general counsel. Jennifer Abruzzo was successful in, for instance, working on ways to increase union recognition. So if like employers union busted and kind of like corrupted the results of an election, there was ways to get that union recognized. Even if the election lost, that was the Chemex victory. And then also basically declaring captive audience meetings illegal, meaning that your employer cannot say you have a mandatory meeting where we are just going to tell you why unions are bad and you cannot, you have to go. That is now still illegal, but basically now that Trump is in power and then their board has like one member and the government is also like shut down, very large employer side law firms have kind of been saying like, well, if you want to, you can maybe just try doing this anyway, because we don't think you're going to face big penalties for it. We think this is a risk you, the employer, can and should take. And because the NLRB does not issue fines, basically like union busting is a gamble a lot of employers will make, because they'll say, okay, well, this is probably worth the cost for us, because they are so afraid of workers building power. So there are so many tactics. Firing people for union organizing is illegal, but it happens a lot. People do get fired for union organizing. I mean, this is a very tried and true tactic employers will use.
Especially in the low wage sector. Walmart does it. Amazon sure. does it.
Yeah, of
Starbucks.
Course. And then just with like the dollar stores in particular and this kind of low wage work, and it's the same for like fast as well. Basically, there is a huge rate of turnover. So you can organize, you can form that organizing committee, but people leave. People come and they go for various reasons. They might say, hey, I'm not going to get promoted and be making more money here. I can get a job that maybe will pay me a little more, and I'm going to go do that. So it's really, really hard to win that victory. And then also you have to negotiate a contract. And even if you unionize one store, this happened in Dollar General, Dollar General did win a union election in Missouri. There was one store, very small victory. Dollar General closed that store. That store doesn't exist anymore. But even if you win that, basically the idea with pre-majority is like either we don't think we can get a majority in our one single workplace, or we might be able to win a few stores, but we will be so far from the over 100,000 employees of, in this example, like Dollar General, that it will still be a tiny fraction. And if you look at the Starbucks campaign, which has won hundreds of stores, I believe there are over 600 Starbucks stores that have won union elections, but this is nowhere near the majority of Starbucks stores. So they're advocating for change, and they are trying to get a contract. I believe they're working to get a contract that covers all of the stores that have unionized. But talking to a representative of the Emergency Workers Organizing Committee, which is also known as EWOC, it's a project of the Electrical Workers Union and the Democratic Socialists of America. He's like, you can kind of think of that as pre-majority unionism because it's not a majority of the workers and it's not a majority of the work sites. However you want to frame it, because there's different ways to look at it, you're saying we don't have a majority, whatever that majority means, but we are still going to organize for change. And you can still call that union activity. And in fact, Kate Bronfenbrenner, who is a labor expert, she is with the Cornell Labor School, and she is a brilliant, brilliant mind. She's been studying labor organizing for decades. She's like, what David and his colleagues are doing, that is a union. You are being a union, and you're protected under the NLRA. Even if you are not a formal union, it's still, you're still engaging in protected union activities. You are still theoretically protected from retaliation and firing. And so you say, like, we're not going to get this majority. We're going to start organizing now.
It's really interesting to hear. You know, I'm glad you laid all of that out, Jesse. Is Step Up Louisiana then part of this wave that you described from EWOC and the pre-majority unionism? Would you call it part of all of that?
I mean, I definitely would. And Step Up is not alone. They've definitely collaborated with other groups. But maybe, David, if you want to talk more about that.
Yeah. And tell our listeners, David, what it means in practice to be part of this organization and how you act like a union day to day.
I mean, well, basically, just like when I'm at work or when I'm off, I normally, you know, do the best that I can to talk to my coworkers and have those conversations with them and consistently keep that relationship going, because the more you conversate about the situation that's going on inside the store, the better the information there'll be to spread amongst others who are afraid to speak out on certain conditions and concerns and everything. Because even when you go to your manager and they say they have an open door policy, like, you can tell them your grievances, but are they really going to do something about it? And 9 times out of 10, we've all tried that and it hasn't worked. That's why, you know, teaming up with Step Up and everything, they actually care about our concerns and our needs and doing their part to give us the resources that we need to deliver that to everybody else who are afraid to have that voice. So even when you are voiceless and everything, there are so many ways to uplift your voice and spread it around for anybody who else who are afraid to step in that moment. And I think it's a beautiful thing to really be unite as one for a common goal.
I was going to ask you, you know, I think you mentioned that you talk to workers offsite, and are you able to talk to them on site? This is a big deal in campaigns. Say Amazon doesn't let you come anywhere near, you know, the workplace to talk to people about organizing. What's the atmosphere at Dollar General? Is it intimidating? And do you get threats for trying to organize other workers? And then maybe I wanted to also know what kind of community outreach and solidarity and support you're getting by what you're doing at the store and outside.
I mean, there were times where the district manager would come in and he'll kind of test me around a bit to see, like, if I'm one of the ones to chicken out or give him some information that he think he could use against me. But he realized in the long run, I'm not one of the ones. Like, you do something to me and I'll do something back to you. And, you know, so he always just tried to, like, you know, pick my brain and, like, ask me a bunch of questions and stuff like that. So it basically came to a time where he was saying, like, well, you know, if there's anything that's concerning or something that you need to talk to me about, like, you have my number. Like, I'm always here. And, you know, you can always tell me what's going on and how we could fix this and stuff like that. So, you know, I kind of shrug it off and say, like, yeah, that's cool and all. But I know your game. I know your game. And you can't pull a wool over my head. Or you can't pull a carrot over me and make me beg.
And so what is the reaction of your fellow workers when you talk to them about conditions, and what kind of, you know, demands did you raise? Like, was it about safety, primarily dignity, respect, higher wages? What kinds of things were you working for, and what did you win?
It's crazy because it's like, I rarely get a chance to talk about it, even when I do, because normally they'll just pop out of nowhere and say, like, oh man, it's like way too hot up in here. Why the AC not on? It's like, oh, they got too many thieves coming up in here. Like, it is not safe around here. One time in a whole chat group that somebody was basically saying, like, the fact that we don't have security during the night shift, that's life-threatening. Like, nobody needs to come to work each and every time and have to feel like they got to look over their shoulders and wonder if they're able to go home at night while still trying to do their job. So there have been many a times I've had this conversation with them, and I'm like, you're absolutely right. Nobody should ever have to feel like they have to constantly look over their shoulders and wonder if they're going to be okay at the end of their shift and go home. Because normally, you don't have a way to go home sometimes. Sometimes you actually have to finish your shift, still look over your shoulders, and have to walk home at night because it's dangerous out there too. So there are times where when you have these conversations with people, and even if you're not forcing it upon them, it just happens naturally because they all feel the same way. And then sometimes we're not heard unless we're heard outside of the store.
So, I mean, this is very common in other organizing drives that they'll go to other workers' homes, or talk outside, find a, you know, like a local cafe or something to talk to. Is that sort of what you've had to resort to? And I'm curious too, because Jesse said that there's a kind of generational divide in terms of attitudes to unions. There's still suspicion among, let's say, perhaps older generations. One of the things that I find heartening is that that seems to be disappearing. Conditions are so bad that most workers would prefer to be defended by union rights and higher wages and all that. If you talk to them about it, it's, you know, ABC sort of.
Yeah. And crazy because as Jesse mentioned, sometimes you do form an alliance or like a committee or everything, and you're all working together and sticking together and, you know, delivering to the common goal. Sometimes it is very simple to join up and everything. But there are other times where if things not shaking or moving and it's like you're not getting promotions or anything like that, sometimes it's easy for them to join up, and then sometimes it's very difficult for people to stay because, I mean, hey, we all got bills at the end of the day. So I totally understand. And it's like it's hard to keep that movement going when people are leaving. And it's for very good reasons, because sometimes it's not enough, you know, and it's like you try so hard to keep everybody honed in and focused, but sometimes it's not enough, because we all understand that at the end of the day, we still got bills to pay. We still got to make sure we have a roof over our head, you know, food's in our belly and things like that. So sometimes wherever you work at, it's not always up to par. And for them leaving like they do, I get it. You know, I never take that away from them, because it's definitely difficult. Don't ever give up.
In your organizing efforts, or in your, let's say, campaign to win people over to fight for better rights, did you get people saying, yeah, I want to join Step Up Louisiana? Or was it like, yeah, I'm on board, but I don't want to join? What did you find when you talked to people?
I always tell folks that it's always going to be a scary moment. It's always going to be fearful, because people always drive off of fear. And when they find a way to take advantage of that, they're always going to get you that way. So yes, it's going to be scary. I mean, even I can admit this was scary for me because I've never done anything like this before. And say that I've been doing so many of these interviews, media, protests, and all this stuff. Technically, I'm still a baby at this. So it's always going to be a scary moment for me. But I always remember to know that I'm never alone in this fight. I always have people that show me love and support. And I just encourage others to say, like, hey, when you join up, just know you're not alone in this fight. You're always going to have somebody around you, somebody that's with you. And we're all going to stay united as one. So when you feel scared, we're all going to feel scared, but we're going to show and look fear right in its eye.
Can you talk about what you've won in this struggle so far?
Well, so I'll say like years ago, I'll say maybe like 2-3 years ago, we went to Goodlettsville, Tennessee, and we was doing like a protest rally in Goodlettsville. The shareholders meeting is in Goodlettsville, Tennessee. That's where Dollar General headquarters is at. So long story short, it was me and other coworkers went up inside the building and we did a statement. And so as I was the one that was reading the statement and everything, I had like, what, maybe like 3 or 4 minutes. So I tried to read as much as I can because everything's so long. So after everything was over with, we're like on pins and needles, just wondering if this thing going to pass. So I heard something, but I didn't hear it clearly. And then everybody like tapping me and shaking me like something big happened, but I don't know. So as we step outside, that's when somebody who was talking to us before, they were saying like, hey, your proposal wound up passing and you won it. I was like, what? Really? We won it? So I couldn't hold my containment. So as I went outside, I screamed for joy because this is like the first time I've actually fought for something that I thought I was going to literally give up on because I'm always giving up on something when things get tough. But I made a full commitment to myself that I'm never going to give up until the job is done because I don't seem like I'm a quitter all the time. So I wanted to really hone in and really fight for this to finally get the victory. And we finally got it. It felt great. But then at the same time, it felt like a slap in the face because they was really just, just put a smile on our face and for giggles and stuff. But beforehand, it really felt like a victory at that time.
But it must have felt like a victory for your coworkers as well.
Yes, it did. It did because, like I said, this was something that not only I fought hard for, but, you know, fighting for others as well because I don't give up on myself. And the people who believed in me, I won't give up on them. And I definitely didn't want to disappoint them. So I just had that clear mind to say, like, I'm not giving up on this. I don't care how hard or difficult it is. I'm going to fight to the very end.
Jesse, maybe you could come in on this and talk about some of the ways that Step Up Louisiana is acting like a union and organizing collectively without legal recognition. And even, you know, in some articles that I've read about pre-majority unionism, that this is just one step for an eventual fight for unionization. But even if it isn't, can you talk a little bit about what you found in your reporting, not just at Dollar General, but also, you know, other areas in the South?
Sure. Well, like when it comes to the organizing that Step Up is doing with the dollar stores, they are agitating and organizing with the workers. Like David was talking about, they got this health and safety company-wide audit passed for Dollar General, and wages have gone up at the companies. There was like $2 to $3 raises at Dollar General and Dollar Tree a couple years ago, and a couple years ago, Dollar Tree also owned Family Dollar. It does not anymore, but it did at the time. What they're doing now is they're putting real resources, because it costs money to mount this kind of campaign. And they're putting real resources into this fight, into reaching as many workers as they can and getting them to join this campaign. And that means like rallies, protests, and outreach, and targeting politicians, shareholders, the corporations themselves, and the workers. Because like David was talking about, you go into a dollar store, you can see for yourself what's going on there. And you can see that the conditions are not what they should be and not what a very wealthy corporation can afford. Like, these corporations can afford to make these jobs good jobs and to make these stores nice places to work. And that isn't how corporations behave. They don't do things out of the goodness of their intentions. They do the right thing because workers and allies force them to in whatever way they can. So there have been a bunch of different examples of this. There was the Waffle House campaign that was kind of spearheaded by the USSW, that's the Union of Southern Service Workers, which is a fight that's also across companies and across industries to organize workers in the South working low-wage jobs from home health care aides to retail to Waffle Houses, which are also often 24 hours, low security, and can be quite dangerous as well. And through pre-majority unionism, targeted rallies and protests and walkouts, they were able to get what are still modest wage increases, but are very like serious wage increases when it comes to how low these workers are being paid. And they're working to end these mandatory meal deductions, which are come out of workers' pay, whether they eat or not. And then also, if you look at, I think this is like a really cool example, Las Deliveristas in New York City, that is a fight to improve the working conditions for these thousands of delivery. Many of them are e-bike riders who are working for very, very low wages in New York City. They work, well, they're independent contractors. They are independent contracting for apps. You know, many would argue, including in California, California has done some really good legislating around basically closing these loopholes so that they are classified as having like more of the like rights and wages of employees by these companies. So, but it varies state by state. And if you're an independent contractor, you're not covered by the NLRA. Nonetheless, these workers are like, well, we're going to organize. We're going to disrupt business and we're going to agitate for change, and got very serious protections and wage increases passed. Their minimum wage is now over $21. It started out at $17. It went up to over $21. And it got expanded to include grocery delivery workers as well. You know, and you have to adapting to different circumstances. New York City has higher minimum wage than Louisiana, which is still at the federal minimum wage. And I would say more, not as good as it should be at all, but a more worker-friendly legislature at the local and state level. And then you can also think about the Fight for 15, which was this big campaign. Yeah. It began over 10 years ago, I believe in 2012.
Fast food workers.
Right, fast food workers to get a $15 minimum wage, which at this point, $15 is not worth what it was 13 years ago. But
they're still fighting for it.
We're still fighting for it. And it actually began as the Fight for 15 and a union. But that being said, even though not every worker has a $15 minimum wage or a union, that campaign has raised the minimum wage in many states. It has been a rallying cry and it has worked. And in many places, the minimum wage has gone up. And that has literally put billions of dollars more into workers' pockets.
Pandemic helped too a little bit on that, on the low wage sector, because
that is like organizing without a union. And we can say that like not all low wage workers, or not a majority of low wage workers in the country, got involved in that campaign, but they still were able to get material gains that improved their lives. And you know, like it can feel like there is so much bad news out there, and there certainly is, but if we look back at the last 10 years, there have been a lot of successes. And just because it's harder to work through the NLRA system now, it doesn't mean that there hasn't been this surge of renewed interest in unions. And unions existed before the NLRA, and they will exist
after
in this country after, question mark? Yeah.
I wanted to ask, what do you think is behind the, you know, not hiring security guards, not cleaning up, not, you know, boarding up areas?
Dollar General, which is the biggest one, but of course there are thousands of Dollar Trees and Family Dollars, has had this like wildly successful strategy of rural expansion to the point where they claim that 75% of the country lives within, I think it's 5 miles of a Dollar General. And there's more than Walmarts also. So it's kind of a playbook of, as we've seen other corporations do, but Dollar General is quite old. It predates Walmart, I believe. Driving out local independent stores that tend to pay higher wages and to some extent build more wealth. Then you have this corporate model where sometimes there is no other option. The Dollar General that I mentioned that successfully unionized in Missouri, their town has this little plea online that they're like, we want our Dollar General back because that was an important resource in the community. So in many cases, I mean, even in my neighborhood, that is the closest home goods, hardware, pet food. And there are also some fresh food, like to me where I'm sitting right now, that is kind of the closest option like that. It's a bit closer than the supermarket, which is also quite expensive. So that's my answer. But maybe David, if you have another perspective.
Yeah. So like piggybacking off what Jesse was saying, it's like that's their model. They're going to target the neighborhoods that's very poor or just have very low income families that doesn't have many resources. So yeah, when you have a store that's like virtually close to it, it automatically states that you're only just have that one option because not many people can afford to go to Walmart. Not many people can afford to go to all these big time stores. So Dollar General, Family Dollar, or Dollar Tree, those are like their only options in terms of getting essentials, groceries, or their basic needs. And then, just as Jesse was saying, sometimes it could be very, very close to you, like walking distance. 9 times out of 10, if you don't have no vehicle, you're normally catching the bus. And we know the buses are not anybody's best friend right now. So it's very difficult to get the things that you need and get the things that you want when they make it so difficult for you despite everything being so close. And they're closing. That's what makes it even more difficult. Yeah. They're closing.
Right. That's what Walmart did, by the way, when it expanded to Ottawa. They had a huge new Walmart, but Canadian labor law insists on unionization. And when they found that out, they had just packed it up and closed it down. Despite losing their investment was less for them than coping with unionized workers. It's really pretty astonishing. But I wanted to go back because, Jesse, you were talking about, you know, how the NLRB was gutted or is being gutted, and labor law, you know, is difficult in any case. But one thing that, you know, there was some protection offered by, you know, being sanctioned as a union. And I'm wondering what kind of protection do you have from management just sort of ignoring or knowing that the NLRB isn't there to protect you? Can you talk a little bit about what that's like? What are the risks, I guess? You've won some important gains and you've organized and you have, I'm assuming, community support for what you're doing. But how does management react?
Well, basically right now, I mean, the way that the National Labor Relations Board works is that you don't go immediately to the federal 5-member board. There's like regional offices that can decide a case, and then it has to be appealed all the way up to the like national board. But like I said, like the NLRA protects, I believe it's called concerted union activity. That means like you can go to your boss and say, I have a problem with how things are being done here. I think, you know, it's problematic that we don't get any time off, any sick time. Your boss can fire you. But if you do that with your coworkers, you are protected under the NLRA, even if you haven't like won a union election. So what I've heard from experts is that we are seeing more of these rights being trampled on. Like I said, the captive audience meeting, they are still illegal technically, but we are seeing employer side union busting labor firms basically being like, well, we kind of think that this is okay. The general counsel for the NLRB that Trump has nominated, or I believe she's acting general counsel, Crystal Carey. She was a attorney for the firm Morgan Lewis, which is a well-known, a very large union busting firm. They're also like representing SpaceX and Trader Joe's in a case that is attempting to completely undermine the National Labor Relations Board's power, which actually had a win in the Fifth Circuit, which is my circuit. So that's Texas and Louisiana, among other states, basically declaring part of the NLRB's authority unconstitutional. Now that, as I understand it, could be appealed at the Supreme Court, but there's other issues there when it comes to the current makeup of the Supreme Court and how they view workers' rights. So that's another part of it, too, is like right now there is one person on the National Labor Relations Board. Trump has nominated two more members who still are awaiting like final confirmation. So there's Scott Mayer. He is the chief labor counsel for Boeing. And then there's James Murphy, who has been counsel to Republican NLRB members. So this is more of a bureaucrat who is like familiar with the NLRB, but also like Republicans tend to be more employer side when we look historically. But I don't know too many specifics about him. So basically, we're just seeing like the entire political system from the Supreme Court to the NLRB. Which right now, again, no quorum. It cannot decide cases. No. Local offices can turn against workers' rights. But again, that's not the end of the story. And workers still do have rights. We still do have the NLRA. So I don't want to make it sound like that no longer exists and that workers have no rights. You do still have rights. You have the right to organize.
Right.
And I don't want that to be confusing to listeners. You have options, and I think a great resource is the Emergency Workers Organizing Committee, which I mentioned earlier. It's a project of the Democratic Socialists of America and the Electrical Workers Union called UE, and you can reach out to them. It's kind of like a warm line, and they will get back to you on like steps of how to organize your workplace, including pre-majority unionism, including you saying, hey, we just want help dealing with this serial issue at our workplace, whatever that is. And you don't have to say, hey, we want to be a union and be represented by UE. That is not the case. They want to help workers organize with or without NLRB elections. And if that means working towards a contract with or without a union, they are there to help people unionize. And I think that that's a great resource.
I wanted to go to some of the positive things that you guys have been talking about, because both of you have talked about the gains from the organizing, the pre-majority organizing, Step Up Louisiana. And then you talked also about the Waffle House raises and at dollar stores, the $2 wage increase, the company-wide safety audit, and the other aspects. And David talked about going to a shareholder meeting, raising awareness. And it just seems to me like this is the kind of bottom-up organizing that is part of the labor movement's tradition worldwide and continues. And I think sitting here in Los Angeles, one of the bright spots of the last sort of 8 years or so has been this surge of union activity and strikes and winning and also support you mentioned for the platform apps, the drivers, DoorDash and Uber and Lyft. But we also had the spectacular UAW victories at the university, at UCs, and we had the writer strike, the actor strike, and all of these strikes that showed not only can you win, but you can get really broad community support. So it sort of shifted the sort of attitude that has existed in the past against unions. And I'm just wondering, because you guys are doing something, and David, you and all the people at Step Up Louisiana are doing something that seems to me innovative and important in right-to-work states and in an anti-union climate. And you're winning, I guess, what we could call micro-victories, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really important. I wonder if you see them sort of coming together and how do you keep the momentum going? You're not, it's not the normal form of organizing where you're moving toward the contract and taking it to the NLRB for recognition and all of that sort of stuff. So it's solidarity unionism, I guess we could call it. But tell me about what it means on the ground for you.
When anytime I see myself or any others like fighting for the same common goal, it just gives me hope that there is chances in this world. And it's like, yeah, it's difficult. Yeah, it's tough. You know, you're not always going to get it right away. But when you see the fight inside of you and you see others fighting the same way as you, it makes you want to continue fighting. It makes you want to continue fighting for others and encouraging others to step up and have your voice heard, you know? And like I said, it's scary at the moment. but you here for a reason, and you doing it not just for yourself, but the people you love, the people you cherish, you know, and you want a better future for them. So it is always nice to go out in this world and try your best effort to make a change, because change is a good thing. Like, you don't want to always constantly go through the same results and you thinking it's going to be different, but no, it's the same. Like, you need change. You know, you need time to develop, improve, and grow. Because if you're stuck in the same element, you're always going to get the same results. So even if it's not the campaign that I'm in, I think it's beautiful that I can be in solidarity with other workers in different platforms and different formats, and just see the diversity in everything that we do. So it's always a wonderful thing to fight for others and people fighting for us.
It's wonderful. I have one question, because it's not a union, it's the Step Up campaign. Does that help, like, with perhaps workers who are skeptical of unions, but they like the gains that they're winning there? Does it help sort of create that, bottom-up organizing and solidarity that you would normally get?
Yeah, and like I said, like, it all starts with conversations. And most of the time, you say the words, being skeptical about it. So I will always tell a fellow worker or people who just have just, like, general questions about what we do and things in that order. I say, do your research, you know? That's what we got the internet for.
Let me just take the opportunity to ask you, Jesse, because we're running out of time a little bit. But I wonder if you thought, because you've really done a lot of work on this and reported on it in Capital Maine and elsewhere, about whether you think this sort of pre-majority campaign is the template, in a way, for organizing in this, especially in the private sector, when you have this sort of hostile environment. Is it a stopgap? Is it a coping mechanism while we have this hostile political climate? Or is it something that you see as the kind of future of organizing?
I think that what is going to have to happen, and I just say this as an individual, speaking for myself, is that labor unions are not going to be able to rely on the NLRA to protect their rights to organize. There is going to need to be organizing outside of these kinds of elections, and there is going to need to be new strategies looking at, like, retail has been somewhat neglected, I would say, by bigger unions because of its structure, because of the way that, like, these types of stores are not that well suited to organizing as laid out in the NLRA. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. But I do feel really inspired by the work I've seen Step Up do. I think I first heard about this campaign while I was actually covering a different pre-majority unionism campaign, which was the Maximus call center workers. I was in Mississippi, and Greg Wilson came and talked about the organizing at dollar stores. And I have seen Step Up members supporting New Orleans city workers who are fighting for their rights as workers who want to organize and have their rights to organize respected. And I have seen them also at the picket line in front of the hospital when the nurses have gone on strike. And I think that solidarity in this time, in this moment, is so important. And I am really inspired by the various ways in which we are seeing that play out. We are seeing, like, the Chicago Teachers Union be so brave in standing up towards ICE. And that is no small feat, you know, standing up to this extremely militarized and very aggressive army that has killed people in Chicago. That has happened. But the Chicago Teachers Union are like, we are going to protect people in our city. I think that is so powerful. So I think that, yeah, tactics are going to have to change. This administration has another 3 years, no matter what happens. And we are not at the end of year one. So the law, the NLRA will not save unions, and it will not promote unionism at this time. So I think that organizing across companies and looking to the South, looking towards fields that are dominated by women and workers of color is so important. And I think we're also recognizing, and this isn't necessarily about the NLRA, but When you're organizing, you're going to organize with people who you do not agree with on everything, but you're organizing to improve your material conditions. That is so important.
I'm going to give the last word to David. I thank you for everything that you just said, Jesse, and it's really inspirational. I also thank you for bringing up the new challenge and threats to workers, which is ICE. We're seeing it all over Los Angeles with ICE invading workplaces, especially low-wage workplaces like car washes and Home Depots. And we've seen now some great victories. We booted them out, you know, of Los Angeles. And it really shows that collective organizing, solidarity, and firmness, it can win, and especially when you get the whole population behind you on that. I don't know if that's been a problem in Louisiana to see ICE going into workplaces. But David, I wanted to let you finish to talk about whether you and how you guys feel for the victories that you've won and what you can take from that to other campaigns.
I just think, like, as far as like all the victories that we've accomplished and, you know, celebrated on, it just goes to show you that that never give up attitude, always fight to the very end. And you're always going to encourage other people to stand up and fight back, you know, because it's easy to consistently say that you're sick and tired of being mistreated. You're sick and tired of being disrespected. You want your dignity. You want your pay to be better. You want to be protected. Well, closed mouth don't get fed. So basically, in the end, you have to stand up and fight back. And as I was saying previously before, like, skepticism is sometimes very scary. So if you're not sure about what information we give you or like what we're about and things in that order, you know, you can always do your research. Google, like we're pretty much everywhere, you know. So it's like mom's the word when we speak on things. But if you want to find out the real truth, like, just Google us. Like, you're going to find out about everything about us, because everything that we speak on, everything is true once you Google everything.
Thank you so much. I want to thank both of you for joining me today and wish you a lot of luck in the struggles ahead. Jesse Baum is a freelance writer, and she's been writing in the Striking Back series of Capital in Maine. It's a labor series, and the article that we were talking about was Dollar Store Workers Fight to Improve Jobs Even Without a Union. And David Williams, who works at Dollar General, is a integral member of Step Up Louisiana in New Orleans, and he has been described as a fearless voice, which you've now heard, championing the rights of workers everywhere. And I want to thank both of you for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, I want to thank my guests today who have taught us that there's always new ways to build solidarity, and the power of the union isn't always in the paperwork, it's in the people. My guests have been Jesse Baum and David Williams, and I want to thank them, and thank also executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor and engineer Juliana Goda, and Aussie Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You can also find information on our program and guests on our Facebook page, and you can listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.
Welcome to Democracy Now.
You're not hearing double. Starting Monday, October 20th, Democracy Now! Airs twice daily on KPFK, 7 to 8 a.m. Monday through Friday, plus 10 a.m. Monday through Thursday. Morning person or not, we've got you covered. KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, and streaming on kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for the world at www.kpfk.org. Support free speech and freeform radio. Peace.
Thank you.